Okay, our final scheduled speaker before the eagerly awaited business meeting is Doug Pomeroy, a recording engineer with more than 30 years' experience. He was a staff engineer for Columbia Records in New York from 1969 to 76. He began work in the field of audio restoration at Columbia and has continued since then, having worked on more than 200 LP and CD reissues. His clients include Decca Universal, BMG, Savoy, Soundies, Baldwin Street Music, Capitol Jazz, Harbinger, HEP, Rykodisc, VAI, Lyricord, and Vanguard, the last one, amongst others. That's quite a list. He continues to do both studio and remote recording work. He is the audio engineer for the International Association of Jazz Record Collectors. And his last note here is not to be confused with Leonard Feather. So here's Doug Pomeroy.
Thank you. Well, fortunately, this is a short one, so we won't be as late as you might think. Thank you. In January 1938, producer John Hammond helped Benny Goodman put on a very successful and by now historic jazz concert in Carnegie Hall, which Columbia has just reissued. Almost 1 year later, on December 23rd, after a year of planning, Hammond presented in the same hall a concert he titled From Spirituals to Swing. It was a sellout. He says there were 400 people seated on the stage. It was such a success that a year later, on Christmas Eve of 1939, he presented another concert using the same name and featuring some of the same performers. Hammond chose the performers for these events and made substitutions when his first choices were unavailable. He had hoped to present Bessie Smith, but she died the year before the 1938 concert, which was then dedicated to her memory. Hammond and his friend Goddard Lieberson drove south to find the blues singer Robert Johnson, only to learn he had just been murdered by his girlfriend. But they found and booked Big Bill Brunsey. From North Carolina, Hammond brought up Mitchell's Christian Singers and Sonny Terry. For the 1930 concert, he got the popular Golden Gate Quartet. His earlier excursions to Kansas City and Chicago had put him in contact with the big three of Boogie Woogie, Albert Ammons, Mead Lux Lewis, and Pete Johnson, and he booked them for both concerts. He also got James P. Johnson, Sidney Bechet with Tommy Ladner, and singers Helen Humes, Jimmy Rushing, Joe Turner, and Ida Cox. Both years, the great Count Basie Band performed along with the small group featuring Lester Young, the Kansas City Five, which was joined in 1939 by Charlie Christian, the guitarist. Hammond had arranged to have both concerts recorded. I was able to find neither where this was done nor by whom. Sorry about that. Okay, Len Frank. Okay, I didn't want to say that's who it was because I was unable to find confirmation. It's a good probability, but sure, I know, but whether that some recordings made there were in fact done in the neighborhood and not in Carnegie.
The point that Benny Goodman recordings weren't made by Carnegie Hall recordings.
The Goodman was not done there, and yeah. So. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I think Phil Schaap has established that maybe, but I wouldn't want to say because I was at the time that I worked on this, I didn't know, and still I'm not positive. In any case, the original discs from both concerts remained in John's hands for some 20 years, during which time he played his favorites relentlessly. In 1953, he decided to have them transferred to tape, and the Columbia Records engineer Bill Savory was enlisted to do the work. Years later, Hammond sold the tapes to Vanguard Records, where, in fact, where extensive editing was done by John Beaumont and Seymour Solomon, and in 1959, a 2-LP box set, 12-inch LPs, of the recordings was finally issued on Vanguard. Sometime in the 80s, the Vanguard pop catalog was sold to the Lawrence Welk corporate entity. And in 1987, Welk issued the same master tapes, used the same master tapes for a release of the original album as a 2-CD box set. It looked like this. Has a different cover than the LP box did, but there are 2 CDs in here. About 3 years ago, I was contacted by Steve Buckingham, a Vanguard producer, about working on a restoration of the previously released material plus any and all unissued performances, and we knew there were quite a few. Thus began one of the most challenging jobs of my career, one which occupied me for nearly a year. Actually, it was longer than that. The most disheartening thing about this work was the presence of second-generation disc surface noise on tape. Noise recorded along with music is much harder to separate from it later on. You might even say impossible. I would give anything to have been able to work with the original discs. They couldn't be located and are assumed to have been discarded. How many times have we heard that? The Hammond estate was contacted. Word came back that all of John's records had been disposed of before his death and nothing remained. I contacted Michael Brooks, who was familiar with what's in the Columbia vault, and George Avakian, who was a producer at Columbia in the 50s. I even spoke to the original transfer engineer, Bill Savory. None of them had any information concerning the fate of the original discs, nor the possible existence of additional outtakes, although they were aware that there was some unissued material. When I say outtakes, I mean something edited out of a performance, per se. We did learn, however, that a few defective discs somehow ended up in the hands of a collector in Sweden. Vanguard shipped me all of their Hammond tapes. These were 7 10.5-inch reels on a quarter-inch Scotch 111 marked unused, 4 reels of Scotch 131 marked original, and 8 reels of various safeties. Markings on the oldest boxes proved, in most cases, to have no relation to what was in them. So the first job was to listen to all of the tapes. However, simply playing the tapes, and you know what I'm going to say next, wasn't easy since several hundred splices opened up as the dried out splicing tape literally fell off the tape while it was being played. Naturally, they all had to be restored. It was helpful to see notes which had been made by the engineer David Baker, who reviewed the tapes earlier when he was an engineer at Vanguard. However, transfers from the 2 different concerts were all mixed up with no indication whatsoever of chronology. So when the same artist performed at both concerts, we had to do some detective work, and in a few cases, we simply had to guess which was the correct year of performance. Altogether, 23 previously unreleased titles were found and included in the new 3D box set, which includes a very informative booklet about the music, really quite nice, with quite nice illustrations, and some valuable information, and the original liner notes plus additional notes by Steve Buckingham, and the introduction to the 39 concert, it's all in here. And another booklet which reproduces most of the printed program from the 1938 concert. I was able to provide the original of this program from my own collection, and as far as we can tell, I have the only copy in existence. And you might ask, where did I get it? Well, I'll tell you, I stole it from Columbia Records when I was working there.
It's good I did.
I found it in a filing cabinet. I'll tell you real quickly. At 30th Street on the second floor, there was a room with old lathes in it and a filing cabinet. And I opened up this filing cabinet, and there were all the original cards for the Vocalion catalog, everything. And I found the original Columbia Ledger. And I found this thing. So I took the ledger and the program from the 38 concert home with me that night, and subsequently I gave the ledger to Chris Albertson, who was writing the book on Bessie Smith. And then I got a call from the lawyers at Columbia because they got word that he had it. And I said, yeah, he'll give it to you. I had never mentioned that I got the program from the Carnegie, but I know Hammond would be glad that I salvaged it, because within 10 days that filing cabinet was gone. And I was told that it had just all been thrown out. I wish I had taken more. In any case, Hammond's original LP release had incorporated all of the best performances with the best sound quality. In other words, there were good reasons why he chose not to release certain tapes. I've prepared a few very brief before and after excerpts, before obviously either the unissued tape or the previously issued tape, and then the after being what I did to try to improve it. Here is a previously unissued performance by Mitchell's Christian Singers. This disc had a particular type of intermittent surface noise, which is extremely hard to eliminate. I guess it's a form of crackle. I use Cedar and a lot of EQ, but the results are admittedly far from perfect. Yeah, these speakers, by the way, are pretty bright, so bear that in mind. The only known photograph taken at either concert, a shot taken from the balcony in 1938, shows only one microphone, but it doesn't show the whole stage. Oral evidence suggests that there was only one mic feeding the disc recorders, perhaps one hanging high over the stage, and a second mic, perhaps the one we see in the photograph, on the stage, feeding only a loudspeaker. And it's interesting, Carnegie Hall has no record of this concert. I mean to say, it's probably in their book somewhere, but they have no artifact, no program, no photographs, nothing. Presumably, no one had given much thought to the results of this mic arrangement, which is that most of the vocal performances and announcements sound extremely distant. In many cases, it is impossible to make out any of the words being sung. This was one of the reasons why Hammond chose not to issue some of the tapes. Here's an example of an off-mic vocal by Helen Humes. Not much can be done to overcome this type of defect, as I'm sure you know. I used a lot of EQ to achieve some slight improvement. In 1938, one of the disc cutters malfunctioned, wouldn't you know, and did not run at constant speed, and also was seriously overcut. So whoever cut these records has something to...
Maybe he doesn't want to be known.
Maybe that's why Hammond never mentioned where this was done. I mean, I wish I knew Hammond, of course. I wish I had been able to know that I needed that information before he died. I could have asked him. As a result, some of the music exhibits drifting pitch, which is exceedingly difficult to rectify. To the best of my knowledge, there are no software programs available which can correct the pitch of a recording of an entire ensemble. I made some manual Verispeed adjustments while playing the tapes. That's a cutting defect. That drop in level was a cutting defect. I don't know why, but. You know, I can barely listen to that because, of course, I hear how imperfect it still is. But I did the best I could within the year that I had to work on this. Many of the previously issued tapes were seriously off speed, so everything was repitched. Equalization had been used by the engineers at both Columbia and Vanguard in an effort to reduce surface noise, greatly boosting low frequencies and filtering out all or most of the highs. As we all know, this is the oldest trick in the book, and it's one which I had to use to some extent also. My objective was to restore a more natural frequency spectrum to make the music sound the way it actually did in Carnegie Hall. My problem was that in reducing the bass and boosting the highs, I simply made audible, once again, the very surface noise concealed by the earlier equalization. I explained to the producer that although I would try to reduce surface noise, in some instances I might actually increase it somewhat for the sake of the music. Tape splicing was the accepted technique for removal of pops and clicks in the 50s. Unfortunately, the engineers didn't make safety copies of the transfer of their original transfer tapes. They spliced the originals. The removal of tape causes does not affect pitch, but it causes the meter of the music to speed up. I found it is possible to partially correct for this by opening up the splices a bit. Doing so creates a very brief and inaudible dip in volume as the full track tape passes over a full track playback head, but it allows about one half of the missing time to be restored. Each click cut out had eliminated, let's say, a quarter of an inch, which at 15 inches per second is a 60th of a second. If you open that splice up halfway, you've restored 1/120th of a second, which doesn't sound like much, but when there are several splices in a row, the improvement is noticeable. Here are two examples. I hope you can hear it. I hope you could hear those. I don't know whether it was worth the trouble, but I did open up hundreds of splices. For whatever, what could you do? The program was thrown away, and I just wanted to get the, since this is music which should swing, namely jazz, I wanted to get the tempo back as close as possible to what it was originally. There was something I forgot to mention earlier, which is that we identified for the first time in doing this box all of the titles which were not actually recorded at Carnegie Hall, but in a small New York studio in June of 1938, before the concert. Hammond must have felt he didn't have as much Count Basie material as he wanted, so he dubbed applause over the ends of these studio recordings and presented them as concert performances. He also recorded announcements at Vanguard Studio and presented them as being from the concert. He even had Seymour speed up the tape so he would sound 20 years younger. we know all of this is true because I had just happened to have an old downbeat that I had saved where Hammond admits that he did all of this. So Vanguard would probably not have taken my word for it, but I had the proof in Hammond's own words that he had done this, simply to make this box set of LPs flow better. But the studio performances are, they're quite good, and they're small Count Basie, small group. We, in fact, found a couple of these which were not on the box set, so we were able to include them all. Another reason why some tapes were unissued, and I'm almost through, is that some of the 1938 discs were overcut, distorting all of the loud peaks. Cedar processing is not really effective, nor is any other computer-based processor, in reducing this type of distortion. It can only be reduced, not entirely removed, but reduced by manually redrawing the waveforms, which I do a lot of, and is very labor-intensive. Here are two excerpts by the Count Basie Band. And I know we're running late, but if there are just a few questions, I would be happy to. No questions? Okay.
Okay.
Well, wait, let's get.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
So we've heard a lot about that, this box. Well, in a sense, there you have it. Now, what I'm going to say right now is we're going to start the business meeting probably.